The Volume.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
Boxing with Chris Mannix is brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any other fantasy sport, there is a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win.
This is Boxing with Chris Mannix.
Oh, somebody punch him in the face.
Anthony Joshua is a composed and ferocious finisher. Watch this.
Andy Ruiz is the heavyweight champion.
Hosted by SI's Chris Mannix.
That was my moment.
Now with interviews, analysis, and everything going on in the world of boxing.
When you have talent, you are given another chance.
Here's Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Boxing with Chris Mannix, part of the Volume Sports Podcast Network. We have a terrific show for you today. Lot of news in boxing right now. No better person to run through it all with than Keith Idek, senior writer for BoxingScene.com. A little bit later on, Shakur Stevenson, the U.S. Olympic silver medalist, the 126-pound champion. He is going for another title, this time at 130 pounds on Saturday when he takes on Jamel Herring. I talked to Shakur about that fight and much more. As always, best way to support this podcast, get over to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate, review. It's the best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to the show. All right, Keith Idek is here. Back again, senior writer, BoxingScene.com. Keith is in Atlanta for this weekend's Jamel Herring, Shakur Stevenson, 130-pound title fight. I know, Keith, much to your surprise, I'm not there. I may have intimated I was planning on going, but life just keeps getting in the way, Keith. Just keeps getting in the way.
Well, what I do know is that they have a sticker with your name on it all ready to go for Saturday night, you know.
In case I send the bat signal up to Evan Korn with Top Rank and say I'm on my way down. We're going to get into Stevenson Herring. Interesting weigh-in on Thursday, or rather press conference on Thursday between Stevenson and Herring. It's a terrific fight. We'll talk more about it. I want to begin the show, though, Keith, looking back to last weekend. Mikey Garcia, four-division world champion, a guy that for, you know, many of the last few years has been either on or around pound-for-pound lists. He was coming off a 20-month layoff and taking a tune-up fight. He was facing Sandor Martin, who had never fought at the world level, had a couple of losses to mid-level fighters on his resume. A lot of people, myself included, believe this would be easy work for Mikey Garcia. But over 10 rounds, he was completely outboxed. He won a majority decision. It should have been a unanimous decision. He was soundly beaten by Sandor Martin, which, you know, I guess raises the question, you know, what is the future of Mikey Garcia? Was it an off night, or was it a sign that a 33-year-old fighter is starting to slow down? So give me a reaction to what you saw from Mikey Garcia.
Yeah, he looked sluggish to me, Chris. I mean, I don't know if it was you know, maybe he didn't have the best camp. He didn't say that, but he just looks sluggish to me. Maybe lethargic might be the right word. And I got to be honest. I mean, I would have preferred to see a much, much greater sense of urgency from Mikey Garcia in the second half of that fight, because he had to know, and his brother is a very smart boxing guy. They had to know he was losing rounds in that fight, despite what he told you in the ring after the fight. He knew he was losing rounds, and he never really turned it up a couple of notches to sort of separate himself the way that everyone thought that he would against Sandor Martin from the beginning of the fight. I was just happy that the two of the judges at least got it right, Chris. I thought he won 7 of the 10 rounds. Two judges did score it 97-93. You know, Mikey Garcia won a few rounds, obviously, but it was just kind of an apathetic performance from Mikey Garcia. And with so much at stake for him, I found that surprising. So it's almost more, not from a physical standpoint, do I question where he is. I question it more from a mental standpoint, because he's made a lot of money, you know, frankly, was grossly overpaid for several of his fights and, you know, capitalized on the market being what it was at the time. But does he really want to fight anymore at the top level? Because I'll tell you what, if that Mikey Garcia got into the ring with Regis Prograis, he would have gotten demolished.
Yeah, badly. I mean, he would have gotten hurt by Regis Prograis, who is a much hungrier fighter at this stage of his career. I was pretty surprised, Keith, at the performance of Mikey Garcia, because you go back to 2016 when Mikey Garcia was coming off a 2.5-year layoff. He came back and he just demolished Ilia Rojas, like knocked him out in that fight. He went on to face Dejan, I'm going to screw up his name, Zatichinin, I think is how you pronounce the last name. And he knocked him out in maybe the best knockout performance of his career. So he didn't miss a beat after that 2.5-year layoff. Now, the difference is the Rojas fight, I think, was at 140 or around there. He goes back down to lightweight for the next fight. So he was in a weight class that made sense for him, where his physical skills were an advantage. I think one thing we've learned, if nothing else, about Mikey Garcia the last couple of years, he's not a welterweight. And he's not, you know, the 145-pounder that he was in this fight. 144 pounds is what he came in right around on the scale. He is 140 or below. So if he's not going to fight at 140, I'm not sure where Mikey Garcia would go from there.
Yeah, he's definitely not a welterweight, Chris, and I commend Mikey Garcia. Of course, he was paid a lot of money to fight Errol Spence Jr., but that was a tall order, man. I mean, he comes off that Robert Easter fight in which he looked excellent and goes and fights Errol Spence, a much bigger, younger, stronger fighter, and he was beaten decisively in that fight. And I thought he maybe unfairly, to a degree, took some criticism for kind of playing it safe toward the end of that fight and just trying to make it the distance and not getting knocked out by Errol Spence Jr. And I don't really blame him for that, because you could certainly argue that he didn't belong in the ring with Errol Spence Jr. to begin with. Again, was paid a lot of money for the trouble, of course. But the difference here, of course, is that Sandor Martin is not a welterweight either. And he's certainly not anywhere near as good as Errol Spence was at the time when he fought Mikey Garcia. He's not a welterweight. I think his best weight now, of course, would be 140 pounds. But I was troubled by his body language, by the way he kind of just went through the motions, in my opinion, for a lot of that fight. Maybe he doesn't want to fight anymore. He's going to do it because he's going to be paid a lot of money to do it. But, you know, I don't know. I don't have any inside knowledge of this in terms of how he feels about moving forward with his career. But there just didn't seem to be that hunger in Mikey Garcia that we had previously seen. Because, Chris, as you well know, Mikey Garcia was not supposed to become what he became. I mean, Robert Garcia was the fighter in the family back when his dad was training Fernando Vargas. And Mikey didn't think he was going to become what he became in boxing. So it's an incredible success story. And Mikey's a very humble guy and likable guy and everything. But I just wonder where he goes from here, because now he's got to get up for a rematch with Sandor Martin, which he in no way is guaranteed. And frankly, if I'm Sandor Martin, I would prefer to go fight someone else and make a lot of money, maybe try to get a title shot, which he seemingly would have earned by beating Mikey Garcia. So that's not going to be easy to get Sandor Martin back in the ring with him again. And again, he should not have been in the ring with him to begin with, probably, right? I mean, credit to Sandor Martin for rising to the occasion and changing his life and his career and everything. But, you know, in some ways, maybe Mikey Garcia and Robert, maybe they got what they deserved on this one. They were looking for what they thought was a soft touch, and it obviously was not.
You made the point, Keith, about Mikey Garcia not supposed to be not supposed to becoming what Mikey Garcia has become. He is. I mean, this is a story you've written, I've written over the years. Mikey Garcia doesn't really love boxing. He's just really good at it. And, you know, he's the best member of his family. But that family, from Robert to his brother Danny to the father, I mean, they are a fighting family. They are a passionate family about boxing. Mikey just happens to be the best, but he probably lacks, no, he definitely lacks the most passion out of any of them. So he's going to have to rediscover that if he wants to get back into this. I wonder, too, about the rematch. Our friend Dan Raphael posited this the other day, and I think there's some merit to it. Like, maybe just act like this Martin fight didn't happen and just go into the Regis Prograis fight anyway. I don't know who's going to pay for... I just don't know who's going to pay for a rematch between Mikey and Martin. I mean, it wasn't like this was Gotti Ward and, you know, Mikey came out on the wrong end of it. It was an incredibly boring fight. I mean, credit Martin for doing what he had to do, being in great shape, moving around the ring, landing those straight left hands, but it wasn't television friendly. So unless Mikey Garcia is going to go well under seven figures to take a rematch, which I don't think he's going to be willing to do, I'm not sure where you turn to broadcast the rematch between these two guys.
I see your point from a business standpoint, Chris, and you're right, but Mikey Garcia should want to go clean up his mess, so to speak. And if that requires him to be paid a lot less than he was paid for this fight, and certainly a lot less than he's been paid for a lot of other fights, well, he sort of maybe owes boxing one to some extent to go clean that up. Because I don't think that you can just, as Dan, I didn't see Dan write that, but I don't think you can just ignore it. Because then if you're Mikey Garcia, who's accustomed to making a lot of money, you can't go to the negotiating table. Just let's say if he does wind up fighting Regis Prograis or someone else, you know, comparable to Regis Prograis, how do you go to the negotiating table and start making all kinds of demands when in your last fight you lost seven rounds to a guy who was a 20-1 underdog? You really can't. So in some ways, whether he has to take a financial hit to do it is sort of irrelevant, in that he needs to go clean up his mess. But to your point, who's paying for it? Because it's not like if DAZN comes in and pays Sandor Martin whatever he's looking for, even if Mikey Garcia does it on the cheap, it would still be a relatively expensive fight.
Got paid $1.5 million for that last fight. It can't be anywhere near there for a rematch.
Right. And as, also, to your point, Chris, it was not an entertaining fight. And that maybe mostly is because Mikey didn't think, really turn it up in the second half of the fight and fight with a sense of urgency. But, you know, maybe the rematch would be different. But I do think that if he's going to go into bigger fights, now, look, he could wind up fighting high-level guys without fighting Sandor Martin, but he would have to significantly adjust his asking prices for those fights because frankly, you can't pretend that it didn't happen. It happened. We all saw it. And it was one of the biggest upsets in recent history. It was right, not from a magnitude standpoint, certainly, but Andy Ruiz was a 20-1 underdog, roughly. I mean, I think maybe Josh was like a 22-1 favorite or so going into that fight. I mean, it's on that level in terms of, you know, of course, Andy Ruiz was more established, and you could argue that maybe he beat Joseph Parker and was undefeated, but.
Yeah, Andy Ruiz had fought at the world level before.
Right,
like,
right.
Sandor Martin had, won at the world level. His best win was probably Kay Prosper in his previous fight. Mm-hmm. And look, I think that might have benefited Sandor Martin. I said this on the air, like the activity of Martin over the last, you know, 12 months, he had fought twice where Mikey Garcia had not fought at all, really, since February of 2020. And he looked like the sharper fighter out there for whatever that's worth. All right, let's move on to the real action on last Saturday night, which came outside the ring between a definitely not staged and completely organic interaction between Devin Haney and Teofimo Lopez. Devin Haney, Matchroom's 135-pound title holder. Teofimo Lopez, who will fight under Eddie Hearn for at least one fight coming up in November 27th. That fight was recently announced, the Lopez-Kambosos fight, which has been snake-bitten for the better part of the last 6 months. Haney and Lopez went at it ringside. They were throwing some weird things around. Haney's talking about his followers. Lopez is talking about his belt. It got kind of goofy after a little while. But Keith, it did kind of get my blood flowing about seeing that fight. I mean, Devin Haney, you know, however you want to parse it up, these are the two 135-pound title holders. They've got all the belts in the 135-pound division. They're both young guys in their early 20s. They're both undefeated. We will all want to see that fight. So I'll ask you this. In the aftermath of that, do you have any more optimism that we will see Haney and Lopez get in the ring?
Nope. And I will tell you, I'll give you several reasons why. Despite your blood flow issues over there, I will say this. I think that Teofimo Lopez, after he beats George Kambosos, is going to move up to 140 pounds. Now, that doesn't mean that Devin Haney couldn't also move up to 140 pounds to make that fight happen. But I would like to see them settle their business at lightweight, where you can kind of see it from both sides. You know, Devin Haney wanted to fight Lomachenko. He feels like he's the real WBC champion. And you, of course, could see it from Teofimo Lopez's side. He beat the guy. You know, there's no one on the Linares win is a good win, I think, for Devin Haney. And, you know, and he walked through something there in the 10th round and then showed some toughness there by overcoming that troublesome moment at the end of the 10th. But, you know, but Lomachenko is a better fighter than Linares, although their fight was competitive, however long, 3-4 years ago, whatever it was now. But he beat him and he knocked him out. So as four other fighters have done to Linares, and Devin Haney did not do. But it is a good win for Devin Haney, and it was a good step in his progression, I think, to show where he's headed when he starts fighting guys at the higher level. But Devin Haney has an expectation, let's say, to be paid a certain amount of money for these types of fights. It's the reason why people complain about Top Rank being cheap, and we hear that all the time. They don't want to pay the fighters what they want, and Teofimo Lopez himself has complained about that publicly, going into this purse bid for this 7 times rescheduled George Kambosos fight. You know, Devin Haney wants maybe more money, and maybe Lopez does too, but Haney specifically wants more money than the fight is worth, probably, because he's become accustomed to making huge sums of money while working with DAZN for lesser fights. So if you're him and you are used to making that kind of money for fighting Jorge Linares, to a lesser extent, Yuriorkis Gamboa, guys like that, you're like, well, if I'm going to fight Lopez, I want X, you know? So is the fight makeable? Is it viable financially based on what both guys' purse demands would be? And I would say at this moment, I don't think that it is necessarily. And of course, Teofimo Lopez has some options on the Top Rank ESPN side, assuming he's able to beat George Kambosos on November 27th, he can go, you know, he has mentioned many times moving up to potentially fight Josh Taylor for all the 140 pound titles, which is a very intriguing fight. The unfortunate thing, just to, as it relates to these lightweights, Chris, we all want to see Lopez fight Haney. We all want to see Lopez fight Tank. We all want to see Tank fight Haney. We all want to see Ryan Garcia when he's healthy enough from a physical and mental standpoint, fight all of these guys. We've been talking about these fights for, you know, I was in my mid-40s when we started talking about these fights, and none of them have happened, you know? We just keep going forward in this vicious cycle on social media. Well, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that, I'm gonna do that. And while what happened last week at ringside drew a lot of attention, I don't think it got us any closer to the fight being made. As I'd like to be more optimistic than that, but I just don't see how, from a financial standpoint, it's doable right now.
No, I don't think this fight can be negotiated between Eddie Hearn and Top Rank, Haney and Lopez. Where I find optimism is if the WBC gets involved. The WBC can order this as a mandatory fight. Lopez is the franchise champion. They didn't want Lopez to be the franchise champion, but they allowed the title to be transferred when Lopez beat Lomachenko. Haney is the regular champion, or whatever you want to call it, the full champion. But Mauricio Sulaiman has said Haney or Lopez is at the top of the WBC's lightweight food chain. The simple solution is, once Lopez gets through Kambosos, if he gets through Kambosos, to order Lopez to make a mandatory defense against Devin Haney, or the winner of Devin Haney versus Fighter X, if it's JoJo Diaz, if it's somebody else, in early December. It's pretty simple. You want to clean up the multiple belts you have at 135. You want to eliminate a franchise championship that you never intended for Teofimo Lopez to have. Just order the fight. Because, Keith, if they do that, the only way for one of the fight, for only way for that fight not to happen then is for one of the fighters to say, all right, I'll give up my belt here. Or, and I just don't see Lopez or Haney taking that route. I'd love to see that fight go to purse bid. I'd love to see everybody get in and bid on it. I think if that happens, there's at least a possibility we could see Lopez and Haney share the ring.
There would definitely be a greater possibility, Chris, if they went that route. But I don't think that that would make it a foregone conclusion that the fight happens, because back to what I said earlier about the money, because if no one is willing to bid what Lopez and Haney feel that the fight is worth, whether those expectations are realistic or not, if they're not going to be paid what they think that the fight is worth, then they simply won't go, one of them or both of them won't go forward with it.
Because, yeah, but doesn't that, Keith, won't that at least if that happens, you have some clarity there. Right now, it's like, all I have in the back of my head, Keith, is sign the contract. What contract? What about the meeting with Bob? Sign the contract. Like, there's so much ambiguity out there at the point.
I agree, Chris. You know, it's fun for fans to talk about, and on social media, people lose their minds about all this stuff, and they go back and forth. And you know, Haney has his fans, Lopez has his fans, Ryan Garcia has his fans, and all that. But I would say this. I just want to preface what I'm saying by just squarely blaming all of this on Mauricio Sulaimán and the WBC, because these franchise championships should never have been invented. They were not supposed to be transferable. The rules change. The goalposts move as they move forward and it suits them. And we should all be sick of it at this point.
I am.
Beyond sick of it, of course. But it kind of is what it is, right? But Lopez has the distinction of having beaten Lomachenko. So in my opinion, that makes him the best lightweight in the world. Devin Haney would have to disprove that in the ring for me, because he's beaten Zaur Abdullayev, and you know, Linares is his best win now, of course. But what I was starting to say before I got on that WBC tangent was just that, you know, Ryan Garcia, we thought that we were going to see Ryan Garcia, Devin Haney, when Ryan Garcia took a tough fight against Luke Campbell, got off the deck, and impressively knocked Luke Campbell out. Now, Luke Campbell's a B-level, he's a very talented guy, but a B-level lightweight, because he's lost every time he stepped up for the most part. But he's a very good fighter, and was still somewhat in his physical prime when Ryan Garcia beat him. That should have made Ryan Garcia, Devin Haney happen. They're both with DAZN. He won the interim title. He was the mandatory challenger for Devin Haney, and they still haven't fought. So, yeah. and he was again going to fight for the interim title. It's like, why would you continue fighting for the interim title when you have no interest in fighting for the actual title? So my point is that just because something is ordered or someone becomes the mandatory or anything, guys can still kind of do what they want to do. And I would expect that to be the case with Haney and Lopez if it were mandated in some way.
I feel like I'm Charlie Brown in this context, and the lightweight division is Lucy holding the football.
Right.
Like, I keep kind of like getting excited that it's going to be there, and then it gets taken away from me. I've got visions in my head, Keith, of Lopez Kambosos on November 27th, Devin Haney versus JoJo Diaz on December 3rd, and then March of 2022, Haney versus Lopez for all the lightweight marbles. And then the winner will be, coming off those two fights, the winner will be a bona fide star. Like, there's a huge upside for these guys to follow that path. The winner would be a big deal.
I admire your optimism.
It's wishful thinking, I think, is better.
But I would say this: if Devin Haney winds up fighting JoJo Diaz on December 4th, that's not an easy fight. You know, JoJo Diaz, as you well know, Chris, you've called these fights from ringside. JoJo Diaz is no easy out for anyone. You know, he looked very good against Fortuna. You know, he fought as a lightweight he kind of fought as a lightweight for the first time. He wasn't supposed to the previous fight, but he was a lightweight. But point being, as a full-fledged lightweight, he looked pretty good against Javier Fortuna, who's probably better suited as a junior lightweight also. But it was a fight, you know, that people looked at as a difficult fight for Ryan Garcia before he withdrew from it. So not an easy fight for Devin Haney. I think Lopez will have an easier time with George Kambosos, despite the buildup toward the fight and some people thinking for whatever reason that George Kambosos has a legitimate chance to win. I don't see that. The only thing that I would say is that I just hope that Teofimo Lopez does not lose focus going into this fight, looking ahead toward bigger things, because, you know, that's always a dangerous game to play. And this is the biggest moment of George Kambosos' life and career. And he will without question be up for it. So I just hope that Teofimo Lopez matches his, and I have no reason to believe that he won't, but just hope he matches his intensity and his focus and handles his business on November 27th.
Yes, and fingers crossed that fight moves forward on November 27th and nobody gets hurt. Because if it doesn't, we should just forget all about it in 2022. All right, let's talk a little bit about the heavyweight division, Keith. I have been advocating for weeks now that Anthony Joshua should look for a new trainer in the aftermath of the loss to Alexander Usyk. It was revealed this week that Joshua has been on something of a stateside tour looking at other trainers. He has been with Eddie Reynoso in Team Canelo's camp. I have heard he's been around Robert Diaz. You've heard some other names that Robert Garcia, I should say. You've heard some other names that have been out there. I think this is a good move, Keith. And it's not meant to be disrespectful to the job that Rob McCracken has done up until this point. It's just that you can't watch Anthony Joshua over the last two and a half years and think that he doesn't need to do something different. Not only do I think he needs a new trainer in his corner, but I think he'll benefit greatly from getting the hell out of the UK for training camp. I mean, he's such a big star in the UK. He can't go anywhere, can't do anything without being, quote, Anthony Joshua. You go stateside, and with all due respect to the heavyweight champion of the world, or now the former heavyweight champion of the world, like, let's say, for example, you go to San Diego, where Canelo trains. Nobody knows who you are. Like, nobody knows. Like, they're more likely to know who, like, Kelly Slater is than know who Anthony Joshua is in San Diego. So I think all these are all reasons for Anthony Joshua to look in a different direction. And I think he is. I think whoever it may be he goes to, whether it's Eddie Reynoso, Robert Garcia, whoever else is on that list, I do think he's going to go in that direction.
Yeah, it couldn't hurt to have a new set of eyes and a new voice in his corner. You know, Rob McCracken obviously has guided to him to great heights, and I thought they did a good job in the Andy Ruiz rematch of boxing in a way that was not entertaining but was thoroughly effective. So they were able to get him to do some different things in that fight that worked to his benefit, regain the titles and everything. But I agree with you, Chris. I don't think it could hurt to not only get a new trainer and a new voice in his corner, but also to get out of England, like you said, where there's a lot of distractions for him and he's a mega star. Whereas over here in the United States, he could walk down the street and I don't think many people would know who he is.
You
would
not know in Southern California, that's for sure.
Right. You might know who he is because, or that he's someone because he's 6'6", 240 pounds and, you know, a charismatic guy. And he's not like a talkative guy or anything, but you might know that he's somebody, but you're not going to know necessarily that he's
Southern
Anthony Joshua.
Southern California fans will probably ask, like, do you play linebacker for the Chargers?
Right,
like,
of that's, course. Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah. Yep.
So it's that kind of thing. Something's got to give here. And time and again, we've seen examples of trainer changes being beneficial. I've talked a lot about the heavyweight division with Lennox Lewis, of course, and Vladimir Klitschko, among others. But a fight we're going to talk about in a few minutes. I mean, what kind of impact has Brian McIntyre had on Jamel Herring? Like, a big impact. He has helped transform Herring from a guy who had 135 pounds, had lost two of his last three fights, who comes to BOMAC, works with him, goes to that Terrence Crawford gym, and turns himself into a world champion with a chance to elevate himself significantly on Saturday night. I mean, it just happens. In sports, sometimes you need a different voice in your corner. I think Joshua has reached that point where he needs a new voice. He certainly needs new strategy. I mean, whoever he hires to train him, I hope the first thing they say is, you were at 240 last fight. Let's get back into 255, 260 for this fight. And let's start playing some bully ball. Let's start going at Alexander Usyk and not play this pitter-patter game of trying to outbox one of the best pound-for-pound boxers in any weight class in boxing. That would be my first piece of strategic advice for Anthony Joshua.
In fairness to Rob McCracken, I don't think he told Anthony Joshua to go try out box Alexander Usyk.
Yeah, but did he say to come in at 240? Like, the 240 thing was wild, too. One of his lowest weights, like, that was...
Yeah, I mean, he's been around that weight less. But the point being, I think that was in Anthony Joshua's mind that he was going to be able to outbox Alexander Usyk, and he was maybe stubborn in trying to prove people wrong that he couldn't do that, and obviously he couldn't do that. So whoever trains him, wherever he trains, he better do a whole lot different, maybe in the buildup to the fight and the fight itself, if he's to have any chance at regaining his titles.
Yeah. What I had heard when he was around Team Canelo was like, Canelo was there, like, you know, yeah, as part of those conversations, like, they're just kind of like, they're just showing him like, what are you doing with this jab and move? Like, mm-hmm, go at him inside, pow, you know, just be physical with the much smaller fighter. Look, again, you're right. Maybe Rob McCracken did have that in his mind, but it's clearly not getting through in the way it needs to get through. And this is the most important fight of Anthony Joshua's career. If he doesn't win this fight against Usyk, it's a pretty significant rebuild after that to try to get him back to that highest level. All right, let's talk about another heavyweight. Dillian White has withdrawn from his scheduled October 30th fight against Otto Wallin. White versus Wallin was supposed to determine the next mandatory challenger for Tyson Fury. As we speak, Dillian White has the WBC's interim title, and if he had won against Wallin, he would have moved on to face Tyson Fury for the full title with the WBC. There have been some questions, Keith, fair ones, I think, about just how injured Dillian White is. Did he look at Otto Wallin as being too big a risk going into a potential heavyweight championship fight against Tyson Fury? Regardless, what's your take on how this should play out next? I mean, Wallin's promoters, his management team, they have been very public with their insistence that this fight needs to be rescheduled. Two questions. Do you think it will be rescheduled, and should it be rescheduled?
No and yes, because Dmitry Salida has a good point. You know, they trained for this fight. They were going to be paid handsomely to go over there. I actually thought Otto Wallin had a very good chance, as many other people did, to beat Dillian White. Tyson Fury told me a couple of weeks ago when we were in Las Vegas about that fight specifically. He said he favored Otto Wallin to win. He's been, you know, spent 12 rounds in the ring and knows he's a tough guy. He expected him to beat Dillian White. So a lot of people were thinking that. The thing that never made sense to me, Chris, is I didn't understand why they scheduled this fight to begin with, because if you're Dillian White, now he want, you know, of course he wanted to make a good payday, and the fight would have been a big fight in the UK and everything. So maybe he couldn't just get in there with a C-level heavyweight and get paid what he wanted to get paid. But I viewed it as a risky, kind of a very high risk, low reward type of fight for him, because I thought it was one that he probably would have lost. And then, of course, you're not the mandatory thing, by the way, just it drives me crazy. The whole thing drives me crazy, because I still do not understand how you get knocked unconscious and then continue claiming that you're the mandatory challenger. Now, he went and cleaned up his mess. He dominated Alexander Povetkin, in the rematch and avenged his loss. But that doesn't change the fact that he was knocked unconscious. He has not been him repeatedly claiming. Now, he should have gotten a title shot at some point. But at this point, he's not being wronged in the sense that I can't emphasize enough. Two fights ago, you were knocked unconscious. There are guys ranked ahead of you who, by the way, have not been knocked unconscious since that happened to you. So it's not a transferable thing, which, of course, there's a lot of gray area with the WBC in terms of what's transferable and what isn't. Now, he's the interim champion, and he did regain the interim title, but that just further complicates this whole thing, because had Otto Wallin won, he would have won the interim championship, but it was not an eliminator. The fight had not been declared an eliminator, so he would have the interim championship, but he's the 20th ranked contender, according to the WBC. Now, I think Otto Wallin is much better than the 20th best heavyweight in the world, but he technically, or according to their rules, is not even eligible for a title shot. You're supposed to be within the top 15 to get a title shot. So who knows? I mean, they make it up as they go along, So it's hard to say what would have been done and what would have been done. But what I think indisputably will not be done is that this fight will be rescheduled. I think they, from a business standpoint, you know, they said Dillian White has a shoulder injury. Okay. They also said that it would not set him back all that long. If that is the case, if you're Dmitry Salida or Otto Wallin, you would say, okay, well then let's schedule the fight for a month later if you're all ready to go. That's what I would say, but I don't think the fight's going to be rescheduled.
Yeah, I feel for Otto Wallin, it was a good opportunity for him, a good payday for him. And I agree with you. I don't believe it's going to be rescheduled. And I also agree with you that Dillian White shouldn't, you know, all the things that are being written, like Dillian White's been mandatory for over 1,000 days. Well, that's not really true. No. Like he would, it's a little maddening. Yeah,
again, you got knocked unconscious.
Correct.
I can't repeat it enough.
Where I kind of lean towards Dillian White is that before that happened, he was being royally hosed by the WBC. Yeah, like he, you know, there was over a year that he was the mandatory and should have received a world title opportunity against either Deontay Wilder or Tyson Fury. He never got that opportunity. So now, even though there might be something, you know, funny going on behind the scenes, Dillian White to me has done enough over the last few years to warrant this world title opportunity. So I say give it to him. If Tyson Fury wants to come back in the first quarter of 2022, White versus Fury is a big fight. Nobody would dispute that White is a worthy, mandatory challenger. Like, for those reasons, I'd like to see Dillian White get that. Not because he's, you know, again, you just Google it. It's like 1,000 days people keep writing. Like, that's not a thing. But before that, he was doing everything possible to get that, to earn that world title opportunity. He's got a great resume at heavyweight. He's fought some of the best. And the reason, he lost that opportunity was because he fought a real guy in Alexander Povetkin, and not a lot of heavyweights are fighting real guys, you know? So I give Dillian White credit for that too. So I'd like to see that fight happen in the first quarter of 22. I think it will happen. I think Fury, who has talked publicly about that fight in the past, even before Anthony Joshua lost to Usyk, I think Fury would go for it. It's a big fight, as we said, in the UK. And I think that's likely to happen.
Yeah, and they want to bring Tyson Fury back to the UK at some point. He's a bigger star now than he was before. Clearly, after this trilogy with Deontay Wilder, he hasn't fought in the UK in 3.5 years or so. So, I mean, he's the best heavyweight in the world now. He's certainly the best heavyweight in England, the best heavyweight worldwide. And I think he would like to fight back, you know, Manchester, London, wherever. And the Dillian White fight would be a big fight back there. And you know, I'm not trying to come down on Dillian White, but there was once upon a time he deserved a title shot, and it's unfortunate and unfair to him that he did not get it when he was supposed to get it. But I just like people continuing to harp on this as if what happened in the first Alexander Povetkin fight didn't happen. It's just very annoying.
No, I agree. It's such a big fight in the UK that I think just regardless of mandatory status, make the fight. Like, you know, put Otto Wallin in a position to fight on the undercard, give him a chance to fight for an interim title down the line. It's not perfect, but I'd like to see White against Fury early next year. All right, let's talk for a second about the welterweight division. Back in August, Yordanis Ugas picked up the biggest win of his career, knocking off Manny Pacquiao, retiring, at least for now, Manny Pacquiao, and winning the full version, or retaining, I guess, the full version of the WBA's welterweight title, the super version of the welterweight title. In the aftermath of that, Ugas, understandably, had hoped to take a unification fight against Errol Spence. That would be an incredibly meaningful fight, of course, but also bring a big payday for Yordanis Ugas as well. The WBA, which is efforting to combine its titles and eliminate the interims and the regulars and all the stuff that has plagued it over the last 5 or 10 years. They said, no, you've got to participate in this box-off. First up against Stanionis, a young fighter who is, 13-0 at this point. That fight's supposed to take place at some point before the end of the calendar year. Ugas is upset about this. Does he have a point, Keith?
Yes, I mean, Yordanis Ugas pulled off what was considered a big upset. A lot of people thought that Ugas was going to win going into that fight. Terrence Crawford was among the people who predicted that he would win. And Sean Porter obviously knows how good Ugas is. He may or may not have beaten him once upon a time. So Ugas should be in a position now where he can capitalize on the biggest win of his career. I'm not saying that if he has a mandatory due that he shouldn't be forced to make it like everyone else. But, you know, the WBA has gotten rid of its interim titles but still has three champions in various weight classes despite getting rid of the interim title. So it's still quite a mess that they've created. And if I'm Ugas, I want to fight. And why shouldn't he be? Let's just say Errol Spence comes back healthy within the time frame that they're saying he can come back. Maybe a little ambitious, but let's say that that happens and he wants to fight Ugas next. Why shouldn't Ugas be granted an exemption to go and fight Errol Spence in a title unification fight? The sanctioning bodies do that all the time because unification fights trump mandatories and optional defenses and everything. So he should be allowed to do that, I would think. I mean, why can't your Dennis Ugas, who completely turned around his career once he moved up to welterweight and has become, you know, a household name might be a little strong, but he just beat Manny Pacquiao. So his life and his career is completely different than it was before mm-hmm. August 21st. And from a financial standpoint, he should be allowed to capitalize on that. Now, I see it from the perspective of Jamal James and Razbad Butaev, whatever, however we're pronouncing it. Butaev is
well
his
done.
Last
well
name.
Done.
I'm not a professional announcer like yourself, you know what I mean? But
I already forgot Stanionis' first name, so it's, you know.
Amontas. It's Amontas.
There
Stanionis.
We go. Amontas Stanionis. Yes. In my brain, I'd forgotten it, so I decided not to say it at that point.
You gotta get up on your Lithuanian history, man. Come on.
I'm trying. Sarunas Marcellonis.
But so I could see it from Jamal James's perspective. If he beats Butaev, and that's a tough fight. I mean, either one of those guys I could see winning that fight next week, main event on Showtime from Las Vegas on October 30th. The winner of that fight would have a real right to say, I want to fight Ugas next. But again, if a unification fight is there for your Dennis Ugas, he should be allowed to pursue it and go make the kind of money that he deserves to make after, you know, taking short money on short notice to fight Manny Pacquiao, because clearly, you know, he didn't make anywhere near what Errol Spence was supposed to make for the fight. And of course, he was not going to pass on the opportunity. But he capitalized on it. He deserves to make the kind of money that the Pacquiao fight should earn him next. And let's hope that the WBA comes to its senses. Maybe we should just get the ABC involved, because one thing that I found interesting, and had it happened before, if the Association of Boxing Commissions would have come down harder on the WBA sooner than it did, we could have alleviated a lot of nonsense related to the WBA over the last few years, because the second that the ABC stepped in and said, hey, look, we're watching you guys. You know, we don't like what's going on here, and we're paying very close attention to what you're doing. They said, oh, okay. Oh, we're going to get rid of all the interim titles. We're going to do that. You know, they got a little nervous, you know, mm-hmm. because they're pretty much unregulated outside of the United States. But when somebody with the type of an entity with the type of influence that the ABC has started dropping the hammer, they sure got nervous. So
yeah,
let's
all it took was Michael Fox getting robbed to get the ABC involved and get the WBA to start acting. I'm with you. And, you know, Keith, I just, if Pacquiao had won that fight against Ugas, there's no way the WBA is ordering to face Stanionis. Like, that's not happening. Like, I think this is in large part because Ugas is not a household name, so to speak.
But how is Stanionis even? I have nothing against.
I don't know that either. That's another good question.
Ugas brought this up. He's a good fighter. I mean, he's very good, and I think he eventually will fight for a world title, deservedly. But what the winner of Butaev? If they were going to order something, it should be the winner of the Butaev James fight, because that fighter would be their world champion.
Yep.
And that fighter should be, and especially Butaev, because when he fought Besputin, you know, won the fight, but then tested positive for a PED. So if there's a guy who deserves a break in this whole thing, now he is getting a second title shot here, of course, but if there's a guy who deserves something done to have something done right to him, as opposed to what has happened before, it's Butaev.
I agree. Logically it makes sense. You have Butaev fight James, and then that gives a little bit more of a runway to Ugas to figure out if the Spence fight is makeable in the first 2 months of 2022, like they've suggested. If by, say, mid-December, that fight does not look like it's being close to being made, then if you're the WBA, you can step in and say, all right, that fight, we don't know when that's going to happen. We're trying to clean this up. You now have 90 days to fight the winner of James versus Butaev. Like, that just seems logical. Stanionis' involvement in this is weird. Doesn't have high level wins. Like, doesn't deserve what would effectively be a shot at the major title. Like, yeah. Ugas has the top version of the WBC title. What has Stanionis done to warrant that type of opportunity? Nothing, in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, the Delorme win was a good win, and
it's
think
fine.
Delorme,
but Delorme's now right, Delorme's no, not but, like the name. He's like the name I, that you kind of.
Delorme's a gatekeeper at welterweight for sure. But Delorme actually fought pretty well in that fight. I thought it was a competitive fight. But I don't. This isn't Stanionis's fault. I totally understand what you're saying, Chris. But this isn't his fault. This is on the WBA. Like, why? Like, how is he involved in this? It should be the winner of Butaev and James gets the shot at Ugas eventually. But if he is able to fight Spence in the interim, he should be allowed to do that.
Yeah. And look, if Spence wins, then you can order Spence to fight the winner of that. And everybody makes more money. Everybody gets a higher profile. Everybody wins. It just seems like logic is not carrying the day here. All right. I want to finish down in Atlanta where you are. Jamel Herring taking on Shakur Stevenson. Shakur Stevenson has had something of a meteoric rise since winning that silver medal at the Olympics. He is a champion at 126 pounds. He is now going for a championship at 130. Jamel Herring, as we touched on at the very beginning, has really turned his career around since he has partnered with BOMAC, Brian McIntyre. I think he's won, I want to say, 7 fights in a row since losing 2 out of the last 3 a few years ago. He's coming off the biggest win of his career against Carl Frampton over in the Middle East. You were at the press conference today, Keith. You saw these two guys kind of staring off. Herring has a size advantage, as we expect. Stevenson will probably have the skill advantage going into this fight. How do you see this fight kind of shaking out?
I think it's a more interesting fight than the odds makers seem to think, and the betting public seems to think, right? I mean, you know, the Caesars Sportsbook has it as 10-1. They have Stevenson as a 10-1 favorite.
That's wild to me. That's
so
wild.
I mean, most of the rest of them are around 8-1, but even 8-1 is way too wide, in my opinion. I think this is a competitive fight. You know, Shakur Stevenson is the younger fighter, and I don't think anyone would argue that he's not the more talented fighter. He is. And some people have targeted him for stardom. Now, his last performance, he took a lot of criticism for the way he went about fighting Jeremiah Nakatia, but he's a very talented kid, and he's still 24 years old. He's still a young guy, 11 years younger than, well, probably almost 12 years, because Jamel Herring will turn 36 next week. But Jamel Herring has enjoyed a revival of his career, as you mentioned, Chris, and it's been fun to watch, because I got to be honest, if you don't like Jamel Herring, there's something wrong with you. I mean, like you need to check out what's going on in your head if you don't like that guy. The guy did 2 tours of duty in Iraq. Unfortunately, had a child die of SIDS. Been through a world of stuff in his life. And if you don't like that type of person, reassess how you're going about life yourself. But having said that, I think that he's become a much better fighter under Brian McIntyre and Red Spikes. They've transformed his style and made him more of a boxer who relies on his length, especially. You know, he's about 5'10" or so. So he's a taller fighter for the junior lightweight division. And they felt that before he came to them, that he was too aggressive. Like, he wasn't relying enough on his natural boxing ability, which he has done more under them. And it's obviously worked very well. The performance against Frampton was Frampton's at the back end of his career, but he's younger than Jamel Herring. That some people thought maybe he had more mileage on him than Herring, even though he didn't have a lot more fights than him. He had a few more fights, but not that many more. But that was an impressive win, because the odds were around even. You know, Jamel Herring was maybe a slight favorite when the fight went off, and he demolished Carl Frampton, who's had a great career, a 2-weight world champion, probably not a junior lightweight. He's better suited for 126 or 122, but it was a very good win. Gave him a lot of momentum going into this fight, Chris. So I think it's to answer your original question, I think it's a much more competitive fight than 10-1. But Jamel's going to have to produce maybe a career best performance. If he's going to beat a defensively masterful fighter like Shakur Stevenson, who has just a lot of natural ability and a high ring IQ.
Yeah. I think what this fight comes down to is, how does Jamel Herring assert his size advantage? If you get into just kind of a clinical boxing match with Shakur Stevenson, you're going to lose. It's probably not going to be entertaining. Like, that's just kind of the way it goes. But Herring, at the Olympics, he was fighting at over 140 pounds. for the first part of his professional career. Right. He was fighting at 135 pounds. He is a very big 130-pounder. And you can see that at the press conference. He's going to have a couple of inches at least on Shakur Stevenson. He's going to have, once he rehydrates, probably a significant amount of weight on Shakur Stevenson. Now, Stevenson may, yeah, maybe even stronger as he gets more and more adjusted to 130 pounds. I don't know. He was clearly shrinking himself down to get to 126. But whether it's using his length, fighting on the outside, or being physical with Stevenson in the ring, that's going to be how Jamel Herring wins this fight. I don't think he can just stand there and trade shots and counter shots with Shakur Stevenson. Right. That just screams like 118, 110 Shakur Stevenson at the end of the night. But if he can bully him a little bit, if he can use that length, this can be a very close fight. This is not a lopsided mismatch that some are predicting.
I agree, Chris. And the one word that stands out in my mind that Jamel Herring used when I spoke to him, he said, I have to make Shakur Stevenson uncomfortable because no one really makes him uncomfortable. They kind of allow him to get into what he wants to do. He gets into a rhythm, he gets comfortable, and then he's very difficult to beat when he's in that type of rhythm and when he's doing whatever he wants, however he wants, and whenever he wants. Jamel Herring has to make him uncomfortable. He's not a – I wouldn't say he's a rugged fighter in any way, Jamel Herring, but he's got to make it physical, and he's got to make Shakur Stevenson know that it's not going to be the type of fight where he can just move around and comfortably box his way to a decision. I'm not saying necessarily that he'll want to do that in this fight, but he did do that in his last fight. And another good point I thought that Herring made to me, and I think we all noticed it during the fight, is when Jeremiah Nakatia, who is, I'm sure, a bigger puncher than Jamel Herring, but when Nakatia hit Shakur Stevenson with a right hand toward the end of the sixth round, it definitely changed the way that Stevenson went about the fight. I mean, he took the shot fine, I thought. I mean, he didn't seem to be hurt. But it seemed to get his attention in a way that he was much more defensive-minded in the second half of that fight than he was in the first half. Because if you watch the first half of the fight, there were times when, I wouldn't say he slugged it out with him, but he definitely stood his ground and fought on the inside and traded with him a little bit. But when that right hand landed, when his back was against the ropes, he took like a – he landed a right hand that didn't land completely flush. And then maybe 2 or 3 seconds later, Stevenson was backed up against the ropes, and Nakatia hit him with a flush right hand. And you could just see Stevenson's mindset change, and he started circling around the ring, and there were maybe 20 seconds left to go in that round, and he you know, just moved his way toward the end of the round. Herring's not as big a puncher as Nakatia, I don't think, but and he might not even be as big a puncher as Shakur Stevenson, who has kind of grown into his man's body, so to speak. I mean, when he first started, he was a young kid, and you remember him from the Olympics and everything. But now he's filled out, you know, and he's doing strength and conditioning at a high level now. So he looks more the part of a 130 pounder than he did when he debuted as a featherweight.
You know, one thing I'm curious about, and you can speak to this too, being down there, but you know, we've heard Brian McIntyre screaming many times before during press conferences and weigh-ins, kind of his thing, you know, trying to get in the head of opponents. But there's a relationship there between BOMAC and Shakur Stevenson. Shakur Stevenson spends a lot of time training at that Omaha gym that McIntyre runs. Obviously didn't do that for this fight because Jamel Herring was there, but you could see at the press conference, like, Stevenson was more focused on BOMAC than he was Jamel Herring. Like, he's looking over, he's yelling back at BOMAC, like, maybe that takes Stevenson a little bit out of his game. Maybe he's a little bit more enthusiastic about standing and trading and doing things that he's not necessarily strongest at. So I think strategically that was the right thing to do for Team Herring, to try to creep under the skin of Shakur Stevenson and try to take him out of his game plan.
And if you notice, while Shakur was looking over at BOMAC and Red Spikes and the rest of, you know, Herring's Jennifer Herring, Jamel's wife, you know, the whole group of his family and friends over there, and was kind of jawing back and forth with them, Jamel Herring never took his eyes off Shakur Stevenson. Not for 1 second did he look over at his guys that were chirping in the background or anything. He was fully focused on Shakur Stevenson. Sometimes we make too much of things that happen at press conferences. They turned out not to matter all that much. I just thought that that was interesting, that he was fully focused. And the second that Shakur Stevenson tried to touch his belt, Jamel Herring got a little irritated. But for the first time in all these exchanges, and he's called, you know, he has said things like Jamel Herring has no heart, which is a relatively silly thing to say for someone who's served two tours of duty in Iraq, obviously. But look, you know, Shakur Stevenson comes from a rough place too, Newark, New Jersey, which I'm very familiar with. It's a war zone of sorts in its own right sometimes, depending on the neighborhood you're in there. But again, Jamel Herring literally went to war in Iraq, so I don't think anything mentally is going to affect him. No mind games or anything like that are going to get him off of his game, because he's just been through too much in his life to have. Now, he might not be good enough to beat Shakur Stevenson. That ultimately might turn out to be the case on Saturday night, but it won't be because he fought the wrong fight or got emotional or did things that were out of character for a guy who clearly has an enormous amount of character.
Yeah, I'm done discounting Jamel Herring. You know, he looked like his career was over. Look, he looked like he wasn't going to have much of a career after the Olympics. I mean, yeah. I think he was 26 when the Olympics were done. Makes a career for himself, loses 2 out of 3, looks like he's done then, claws his way back, wins a big fight against a bigger name in Carl Frampton. He may lose, but the idea that he's a 10-1 underdog, an 8-1 underdog, that to me is complete nonsense. This is going to be, I think, a very competitive fight. Keith, make sure when you get ringside, they have a seat for me, like just in case I decide to hop on the Delta flight straight to Atlanta. Atlanta's a big Delta hub, as you know. Like, you know, maybe I'll catch one.
I flew Delta from Newark. I ordinarily fly United, but I took my Delta flight right down here. But
big Delta.
Chris, we'll save a spot for you. It'll be empty the entire night, which is fine by me because I can just put all my stuff where you were supposed
correct.
To sit. So it's all good.
You know? Correct. Just yeah, it's like your own luxury seat there, like being in a movie theater. Keith, enjoy the fight, man. Always good to catch up.
Appreciate it. Same here, Chris. Take care.
When we come back, my conversation with Shakur Stevenson. So with big fights every week, there's never been a better time to give FanDuel Sportsbook a shot and join the action on FanDuel Fight Nights. Because right now, you can place your first bet risk-free. That's right. You'll get up to $1,000 back if you don't win. FanDuel gives you many bets to choose from. There are parlays, round props, method of victory bets, and so much more. Now, I am looking hard at the Shakur Stevenson Jamel Herring fight this weekend. Herring is a big underdog. I don't think he should be. I think that's a very good value bet to put your money on Jamel Herring. Offers like this are just one of the many reasons I love betting on FanDuel. It is the number one rated sportsbook app in America. It's easy to use. There are safe and secure payouts, and there are fast payouts. The app is so easy to navigate, and when you win, you'll get paid in as little as 2 hours. With FanDuel in your corner, you'll always get exclusive odds boosts with great promotions and so much more to make your FanDuel fight night even more exciting. That's why they're America's number one sportsbook. Sign up with the promo code BOXING to bet risk-free up to $1,000 on FanDuel Sportsbook. Download FanDuel today. That's promo code BOXING.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by 3-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game, King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think he could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of
that. Like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Now, I'm supposed to talk here about what I remember and what I loved about my first car. And that's easy for me to do
because I still have my first car. And as long as it keeps running, and so far so good, I intend to have that car probably until the day I die. That's how much I love that car. It is like a child to me. Now, it does require some upkeep, and that's why I'm grateful for a place like eBay Motors. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, Shakur Stevenson is here. Did you catch the shouting match between Devin Haney and Teofimo Lopez last weekend?
Yeah, I've seen some of the videos.
What'd you think?
I mean, it's good for boxing and good for the fans that you got two fighters hungry and want to fight each other, willing to fight each other. And I think after they fight, the promoters and everybody need to get together and make that fight happen.
You think it matters how many followers somebody has or how many belts somebody has that seem to be the – or how much money somebody makes?
I mean, I get what both were saying. I think Devin only brought that up because of T.O. said that he's using him for clout or whatever. And Devin had to let it be known. Like, I already been somebody before you had that all on belt, so it don't really matter. Like, I'm not using you for clout. Like, it's just a big fight and – I feel like what T.O. was saying about the belts, I got more belts than you. That's a solid comeback line. So I respect what both of them were saying.
How much do belts matter to you?
Belts mean everything to me. I'm not going to lie, but as I'm getting older, I'm starting to realize that the big fights and big money fights is just as important.
Yeah, I mean, when you get to the big money fight level, I don't think fans really care what belt's on the line or what's at stake.
Exactly, like a Canelo, 24 Floyd, and stuff like that. That's like next level stuff. So fans want to see that more than they want to see four belts on the line in an undisputed match or stuff like that. So
I couldn't tell you. I went to 20 plus Floyd fights over the years. I could never tell you what belt was on the line for any of them. None of it ever mattered. It didn't. Nobody ever gave a shit, you know?
Yeah, especially once he got older, it's like he just, he was just fighting and be fighting. And it didn't matter about belts, nothing. It just was, greatness. Mm-hmm.
You are a young fighter, but chasing greatness yourself at this stage of your career. Second fight for you at 130 pounds. You're jumping right into the deep end in a title fight.
Third fight, sorry.
Actually, my apologies.
No, not even. This is my fourth fight.
At 130? Okay. I thought you defended your title before. All right. Well, early in your 130-pound run here, you're jumping right in against Jamel Herring. Why was it important for you to get this fight right away?
I mean, I just feel empty without a belt at the end of the day. Like, I feel like fighters running around here with belts and stuff like that, and I can't just go to a new weight class and not have a belt, so. That's really one of the main reasons. So it didn't matter who it was, as long as it was the champion. That's good with me.
How do you feel at 130 compared to 126?
I feel like at 26, I was a lot bigger than people. So at 26, even when I fought Joey, it was kind of like I was fighting a good fighter, a solid fighter that everybody finally get to see that he's a good fighter, but I felt bigger. Like, I felt like a bigger fighter. And as when I moved to 130, now I started to feel like the smaller guy. I'm the smaller guy in the ring. And even with this fight, I feel like Jamel Herring is naturally the bigger fighter. And which, like, yeah, I realized that really don't mean too much, though, when you're skillful. When you got fighters like me, skills is going to carry me to these weight classes. And I should be straight in any weight class that I get into. I spar with guys like Regis Prograis, and he walks around super big, but I could sit there and work, have him any rounds he want to work with him. So weight don't really mean nothing.
What's sparring with Regis Prograis like?
It's actually fun. I'm not going to lie. It's real fun. He's like a super tough dude. Like, yeah. So Like, when you watch his last fight, I was thinking, like, he looked kind of, like, sharp in boxing and stuff like that. But then you get in the ring and you spar him, it's like, he just, you know, he coming to fight. Like, he not going to try to be real skillful in there, especially not with, like, somebody like me. I'm a real skillful fighter, and I know how to set things up, break people down and stuff like that. But with him, it's like he's coming in there to make me work. Like, he got to make me work just so it could be that kind of match. And he kind of bring the best out of me too, because once he make me work, now I gotta work. And it's like, you know, it's gonna turn into a street fight at times, turn into a fight at times. And I mean, it was fun. It was real fun. Yeah,
as big as Jamel is, and he's a bigger 130 after coming down from 135, I would imagine no one's as physical as Regis Progre, as far as I can tell, in these lighter weight classes. He's a bull in a china shop sometimes.
Nah, nobody is physical as him. He's real tough. Like, he's and he throw you off. It's like, you know, you expect like a black fighter to be a boxer, but he comes in there, he's throwing nonstop punches and bringing his weight. And me and him wrestling, and you know, we fighting, and last couple of rounds we digging, and you know, it's great work, man.
Yeah, you got to learn a lot from experience like that. I mean, a championship guy who fights that style.
Yeah, I've been doing this. So you got to realize I've been sparring with Crawford, and I've been working with these kind of fighters. So, like I said, that side stuff don't really play too much of a part.
I thought it was interesting at the press conference to announce this fight a little while back. You told everyone, like, listen, Jamel and I are not friends. Like, I don't know where this narrative came from, but he's a cool guy. We share some mutual acquaintances, but we are not friends. What is your relationship with Jamel Herring?
The thing is, I don't got no beef with him. Like, I ain't really beefed out with him, but at the end of the day, they try to make it seem like friends become enemies, and I just disagree with that, because it's like, that never was my friend. Like, I didn't call Jamel like, yo, let's, you want to fight, or like, how we going to do this? Or, like, it didn't matter to me. It was like, put Jamel in front of me, let's fight. Let's see where this goes. Like, so I never really looked at him like my real friend. I just see him around. Somebody I see around in the gym and stuff like that, but never was my friend.
Do you prefer kind of having beef with guy that you're fighting, whether it was Joette, you know, that which was deeply personal at the time, versus you know, someone that even if you're not friendly with, you're not unfriendly with either?
Nah, I really don't care. At the end of the day, I'm not gonna be nice with anybody that I'm fighting. If I sign on the dollar line to fight you, I feel like it's war. At the end of the day, you got to go in there with a war mindset. I'm not going in there to smile with you, touch gloves, none of that. We're going to touch gloves in the beginning of the fight because we have to. But other than that, I'm not going in there to be friends with anybody.
His team, which you acknowledged, BOMAC, the people in that Omaha gym, they know you pretty well. You've been there a lot. Do you look at that as being an advantage for Jamel Herring?
No, because I know them pretty well, too. Mm-hmm. I know everything that they're doing right now. I know when he work out, I know what workouts he doing. I know they didn't switch nothing up. But even when I watch what they post on their stories, I'm thinking in my head, like, it's the same thing I was doing my last camp. So at the end of the day, we both know each other. And then you got to realize I'm used to going against BOMAC. When I go in the gym and I spar with guys, BOMAC got 100 different guys that he want to test out to see how good they are. And he going to use me as a measuring stick. And I get to always beat up on BOMAC fighters, so I'm used to it. I'm not gonna lie.
So this is just another BOMAC fighter for you to beat up on?
Yeah, it's basically same thing as, you know, when I'm in the gym sparring with BOMAC fighters and I'm beating him up and he's screaming at him. And he walk away from the corner like he mad and he don't want to coach them no more or whatever. Or even the guys he be sending home, like it be fighters he bring in, and once I spar them, you never see them again. Like, I promise you, it'd be fighters like that. So at the end of the day, it's another day in the gym come Saturday night.
So Herring impressed a lot of people with his win overseas against Carl Frampton. Did he impress you with that win?
No, not at all. I wasn't impressed with that win. I was more impressed with the Ito win than the Frampton win because of the fact that Frampton is a small guy. Like, he's a little dude. He's a guy that came from 118. And weight class is that low, and then coming up to 130 pounds to meet Carl Frampton, who's naturally a 140 pounder. Like, he fought 141 in the Olympics. Like, he fought 35 damn near his whole career. Then he's moving down to 130 once he got with Womack and them because, you know, he trying to beat a bigger guy and bully all the smaller guys. But that's how I look at it. I looked at it like he was just a bully in that fight. He fighting a little dude and he took advantage of what was presented.
Do you expect him to come out on Saturday and try to bully you?
Yeah, I do. I do, but at the end of the day, I ain't never been scared of no bullies. Like, I ain't got that. That's not in me. So, I mean, you know, I've been, like I said, I be sparring with big guys who try to bully me all the time. Like, even, you feel me? Like, we just talking about Regis. Regis is a great fighter. But just being in the ring with that caliber of fighter, sparring with him and then going to fight Jamel, I'm not too worried about him coming in there to try to bully me.
You know, you have, you know, the world title, the Olympic silver medal. You've got a lot of skill, obviously. Do you feel any pressure to be more entertaining at times in the ring when you're fighting?
Yeah, sometimes. But sometimes I am. Like, you can't, like, take stuff away from me. When I brought boxing back, I stopped that dude with a body shot. Even watching that whole fight, I looked super sharp. I did my thing. Then after that, I went in there with Toka Khan and I chased him around the whole fight. Ain't like I was backing up, playing it safe. I chased him around the whole fight and he held on to me and so did whatever he could to survive the whole fight. So I had one bad night where, you know, I decided to box and I wasn't feeling as good as, feeling as sharp as I usually am. And I took the easy road and said, I'm going to just take my win for the night and we're going to move on to the next. You know, fans, everybody go crazy and they complain and everybody make this crazy stuff up. Even Tim Bradley, who throws me off that he was a fighter before, he started to make me think he was not a fighter. And I literally watched his whole career. So, like, it's weird with Bradley. Like, he sit there and talk all that crazy stuff. But two fights ago, he wanted to put me on his pound for round list. It don't make sense to me. Like, how you want to put somebody on your pound for pound list when I'm telling you, I don't even think I should be in a pound for pound. I haven't proven myself yet. This man telling me, no, you are. You are skillfully that good. And then the next fight, I put him to sleep and I'm a boring fighter. And now he's talking bad about me on air. And man, I don't know, man. These commentators and that used to be fighters throwing me off, man.
Did it bother you more that it came from a former fighter?
Yeah, it bothered me more that it came from Tim, just because of the fact that I know he was a fighter before. And even some of the stuff he's saying on air, like talking about ticket sales and all that kind of stuff, like he was just this big star. Like, I'm confused. I never knew Tim Bradley was a big star. I think even – I don't even think right now, like, we go outside and we ask the – normal person right now, who is Tim Bradley? 9 times out of 10, they'll tell you the commentator for ESPN. He probably got more looks at being a commentator than he was a fighter. So people won't hate that I say that, but I just got to be real about certain things. And he can't sit there and talk bad about somebody else when he wasn't doing even some of the stuff that he was saying. I've seen some bad nights with Bradley, with Devin Alexander and a bunch of people. So we, you know, like I said, we're going to keep it player, but it kind of disappointed me a little bit looking at Tim say all the things that he said, being that he was a fighter and he'd been in my position before.
You know, as you, when guys come up in weight, you know, sometimes the natural growth as you're experiencing makes them a little bit stronger. I mean, I remember calling the fight for JoJo Diaz over the summer and I didn't think JoJo was going to be good at 135 at all. And then I look at him and he's like, wow, he looks really comfortable at this weight. I mean, do you feel more comfortable at this 130? How do you think that's going to impact, you know, kind of your strength and power?
I think it will. I think that as I've been feeling even in my other fights, that I feel good at 130. 130 is more my weight and I feel a lot sharper, stronger, a lot more physical. I think that it's going to carry over in this fight with Jamel. So. Everybody gonna see October 23rd.
you know, you have a chance in the next year or so to collect those titles, to do some big things at 130. One of the potential opponents would be Oscar Valdez. Do you look at Valdez differently in the aftermath of that positive test?
Yeah, I do. I think that that wasn't fair the way that they carried it. And I don't think that, that if that was me, I think that I would have like a way harsh punishment. But it is what it is at the end of the day. When we end up fighting, I'm going to make sure I test him a lot during that camp as much as I could. So that way we know he's not going to cheat me and he's not going to get away with cheating with me. So
I got you. Well, Shakur, it's been fun watching you rise the ranks, man, since 2016. Looking forward to seeing you fight against Jamel on Saturday. And, you are bothered by Tim Bradley's criticism, but you tell me my scorecards suck all the time. So it's you're cool with non-boxer criticism, right?
Oh, yeah. Now, your scorecards is bad. I'm not going to. you got some bad scorecards, but, you're going to get better. You're going to get better as you keep going, man.
Every day in the gym, Shakur. Every day in the gym. Good to talk to you, man. Good luck.
Yeah, good talking to you too, man.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Keith Idek and Shakur Stevenson for joining the show. As always, subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you download podcasts. And I'll see you next week.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.